Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Arts Talk with the Johnson Brothers. Your hosts are printmaker, painter, illustrator Dwayne Johnson, and actor, director, playwright, cartoonist Dennis Johnson. Each week they'll bring you guest artists who will talk about what it's like working in their selected field of art, their careers, and any upcoming projects they might have. Now, here are your hosts, Dwayne and Dennis.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Our guest today is an actor, writer, filmmaker, model. He's co-founder and executive of Tortoise Entertainment. Welcome to the show, Hoyt Richards.
Oh, thanks, guys. Nice to be here.
Hoyt, when did you first realize that you wanted to be in show business?
Oh, boy. It was definitely an evolution. It wasn't really any kind of a realistic plan I had. I mean, you know, I was playing football at an Ivy League school, which is like glorified high school football. So I didn't have any real delusions of going pro, but that was really my main focus. And then my shoulders were getting all banged up, and I had to find something to really take care of my time and my very sensitive 21-year-old ego at that time. So I actually stumbled into meeting someone who was doing commercials in New York when I was up there trying to see a shoulder specialist to see if I if my shoulder problem was something I could play with or not. And the same day I found out I couldn't play anymore football, that I found out this agent was interested in sending me out commercials. So I started very simply like that, and then I went down a tangent with the modeling thing. I think that kind of fell in my lap unexpectedly, and I went down that road for a while. But it was always gnawing at me that I always loved movies and always grew up watching a lot of movies that kind of touched my life in a positive way, and I always thought it'd be fun to give that a shot. So after a 15-year modeling career, I decided to shift gears and move out to Hollywood and really pursue it. So that was around 2000, and that's how it all began.
Now, you're considered one of the world's first supermodels, male supermodels.
Yeah, if you believe everything you read on the internet, I guess. I was just very lucky. I came in on the coattails of all the girls that were. That's where that whole name supermodel came about. You know, I was.
Right.
If you consider like my class, like you'd have in college. You know, I entered the business the same time as like Cindy Crawford and Christy Turlington and Naomi Campbell. So I was around at that time, and while they were garnering all the attention, at some point someone said, "Well, who's how come there's not a male supermodel?" And that just happened to be the time when my career was peaking, and somehow I ended up with that title of sorts. But it's I don't have any S on my chest, and it's not one that I identify with too much. It's kind of a silly title, the supermodel thing. But you know, what are you going to do?
Use it.
That's why we poke fun at it in dumbbells. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I couldn't help myself but be able to be a little sarcastic about the crazy career I've had.
Now, modeling and acting, although there's some similarities, there's a lot of differences. What's something or some things in modeling that's helped you for an acting career?
Well, I mean, I'm definitely comfortable in front of the camera. That helped a lot. I mean, by the time I really put my focus on acting, I had already done about 300 commercials. So, you know, commercial acting is very different than maybe film acting, but as far as being comfortable on set and being comfortable in front of the camera and working with directors, all of that I think was a plus. You know, the negatives were when I really kind of hunkered down and got into acting class. I remember one of my first acting teachers saying, "Hoyt, could you just take the pole out of your ass, please? What are you doing up there?" Because the thing is, as a model, you're very conscious of your body position, the angles you're giving for the camera, all that sort of thing. And obviously when you're acting, you need to just throw all that away and just plug into what's happening in the scene and obviously the other actors in that scene. But
right.
It took me a while to shake loose some of my model habits of when having a conversation with someone, always wanted to give them my best side.
Yeah.
So, yeah, old habits die slowly, but yeah, I got that.
Got to do the head turn just right.
Yeah, exactly. I always find that moment to put in my blue steel whenever it seems appropriate. It just doesn't accent. Yeah. Yeah,
tell
crazy.
Us a little bit about some of the movies you've been in.
Well, I've done about 25 movies so far. It's been an interesting journey in the sense that, you know, everyone always talks about agents and that sort of thing. I think out of those 25, only two of them came through agents. So I basically have, you know, just to hustle and got my own work through either contact I had or people I'd worked with before, who then went on to do, like, doing a short with them, they went on to do a feature, stuff like that. So I've stayed in the independent world. Yeah, my very first experience was on the studio level. I actually booked a job with Fabio, who's a longtime friend of mine, Angels in Exorcist 3. And we got cast in this scene with George C. Scott, and he was having this kind of crazy dream sequence where he's kind of way station in between Earth and Heaven. And at this station, you know, there's a bunch of like Dante's angels there. And Fabio and I were two of them. Patrick Ewing from Georgetown, he was one of them. I mean, it was just all these random people. So it was, to say the least, pretty humble beginnings. I don't think we even got to say a word. But since then, I quickly, when I moved to LA and really wanted to go after the acting, I quickly realized that the challenge with being an actor and also starting a little bit later, like I was at that point, I was, in my 30s, there was a lot of attitude of kind of saying, why weren't you here in your 20s? And of course I had good reasons for that, but not reasons that they wanted to hear. And,
right.
And that's how I started actually, writing, because I quickly realized that the actor position within the food chain of filmmaking, unless you're in that rarefied movie star air, is a very replaceable position. And so since I was already starting a little bit late and was going up against actors who had huge resumes and I didn't, I quickly assessed that the business is driven by content. So if I could become a content creator, that I might be able to actually start driving my career rather than waiting for the phone to ring. So I started really focusing on script and screenwriting. And that's actually, Dumbbells is the first film that was made from a script I wrote. So that was very exciting for me. And that was really, for me, a point of view of kind of cracking the code. And then also realizing you have to learn how to produce, because if you're just the writer and you don't really have a say in how your script gets executed, you know, you can be disappointed sometimes. And my feeling has always been, you don't have to agree with me all the time, but you do have to listen to me. So I just want to have a voice in that creative process. And that's why I learned how to produce as well. And, hopefully next year I'm going to be directing my first feature, which will be a lot of fun. So I'll wear whatever hat I have to, put it that way.
Right.
Is there a particular hat you like to wear more than any other at this point, or are you just enjoying them all?
Yeah, I would say I definitely, the two I enjoy the most are the acting and the writing. Post-production is something I've had to become good at, just because with independent films, usually everyone starts peeling off as the film starts moving into post-production. Like the Herculean effort is to get the movie shot and in the can, but when it gets into the tedious aspect of post-production, it's amazing how people just are either off to another job, or the people that you've gotten involved on that side are either, you're calling in favors and stuff, so things aren't working out as well. And so I've had to learn about editing, color correction, and all sorts of like post-supervisor type techniques, just because out of necessity. I mean, at the end of the day, most independent films are just all the way down, and everyone else kind of, for one reason or another, kind of falls by the wayside. So since these have been projects that have been important to me, I've been one of the ones having to kind of make sure we get in.
You mentioned the that you've worked with some of the people, maybe like from a short film onto a feature. Talk a little bit about how connecting with different people that has helped you. Otherwise, like I know you're big on the festival circuit.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think any industry is relationship driven, but I would certainly testify that the movie business is extremely relationship driven. That's how I more or less, you know, develop the resume I've got, is by, you know, having friends who were doing projects that either were going to hop on board of what I was doing, or I was hopping on board of what they were doing. And the first way I learned that was actually when I got to LA, there's the AFI film program. And since I was already a SAG actor, the AFI's got a requirement that for the first year of that program, and they have SAG actors. So you enter something called the SAG Conservatory. I think it's like $30, and that puts you in the talent pool. And then they, for each person going through the program, they can only select actors from that talent pool. And so I did like, oh my God, I must've done probably a dozen of these short films. They have to do three a semester. So I did that for probably two or three years, and I just got to know a bunch of terrific filmmakers as well as producers, and I'd say out of those, I think at least four of them went on to do features that I did with them. So that was my first experience of realizing, oh, it's smart to like just actual filmmakers who are actually driving their projects and get to know the ground, so as their career rises, potentially you can rise with them. And and through my exposure to what these, you know, these guys were doing, I kept thinking, well, I kind of want to get in there and do my thing too. So it was a way for me to get comfortable with the fact that maybe I could also produce and write and direct. So it's been, I think the biggest challenge of most actors is that they keep the bar too low as far as their expectations for themselves. And you can't act every day unless, you know, if you did that in your room, it'd probably put you in the loony farm. So something like writing you can do every day, and certainly anything on the production side, you can help out on sets. There's always looking, even if it's just being a PA, there's always opportunities to learn the business. And if you really do want to act, there's nothing wrong with having other skill sets that make you more appealing, that when you get hired, they're getting a bonus plan of someone who actually knows story, someone who actually knows production, someone that can actually offer some point of view that might be, you know, helpful to the production, rather than just go back to your trailer and kind of just go over your lines.
Especially in the independent film business.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the independent film business is a, I love it, just because ultimately, for the most part, you're able to just go out and make the movie you intended to make without someone looking over your shoulder, kind of calling the shots. I mean, my experience with studio movies is limited, and it's not that I wouldn't do a studio movie. I'd be happy to, but I, you know, all my friends who are doing don't want you until it's your turn to, you know, arrive and do your thing. And, I'm in there from the embryo all the way to birth, and that part I've just fallen in love with, just because process. I guess playing team sports all my life, I'm a team player, so I love the whole collaborative aspect of filmmaking. Certainly, independent filmmaking lives or dies by, you know, your ability to put together an effective and efficient team. So I can certainly say most of the films I worked on, were more lessons of what not to do, but those are the best lessons to learn, because when you're in a critical situation, you know, going forward, and someone throws out the idea, well, we could do this, you're like, no, you don't want to do that. I did that on this other film, and this is how that turned out. So you can actually develop quite an array of experience from being on films that maybe are falling short in many ways to, as the greatest school, in my opinion, just hopefully making better films. You know, it's a school of hard knocks.
Right. Talk a little bit about Dumbbells. What's it about?
Yeah. Well, Dumbbells is, like I said, will always be my firstborn as far as something I got to write. And I wrote it with another actor. And we wrote it, his name's Brian Drolet, who's one of my best friends. And Brian and I wanted a vehicle where, you know, we could actually star in it, and we knew that, that no one was going to hand that to us, just because neither one of us were known in such a way that someone would get behind it. So we know unless we could write a script that would hopefully be funny enough to get someone to want to invest in it, that was the only way it's going to happen. So that really became our goal, and it was just one of those incredible experiences of. Basketball, I play football, and there's just such archetypal comedic characters in every gym I've ever been in. We thought, well, this is just a great backdrop to tell not only a funny story, but just have innate comedy. So the interesting process of the writing process for us was we immediately tried to kind of, we wanted the tone to be like the 80s comedies where you had a lot of quirky characters and a lot of kind of, you know, absurd hilarity in the situations, but we also wanted to have some heart. And we found that the more that we injected parts of our own life into the script, the more people responded to it. So it's funny, Dumbbells is actually more semi-autobiographical than people would ever imagine. And that was really one of the great experiences of writing that script, was to realize that it's great to want to make a funny movie, but the more of yourself you put in it, you know, the comedy was actually heightened because it was actually coming from genuine places.
How did you get Carl Reiner in the film?
Well, this is a great example. I mean, basically every name that's in our film, and we have about half a dozen, was a contact to somebody. So Carl Reiner was good friends with Nancy Olsen, who plays his wife in the film, and she was the mother of the director. So basically Nancy Olsen had been in Sunset Boulevard. Yeah, exactly. And so she had known Carl, and basically when she, you know, when her son, you know, Chris was doing this movie, she's like, oh, you know, she'd get Carl. And we were like, are you kidding me? So that was amazing. And then one of our other producers knew Jay Moore, and he knew Tom Arnold. That's how we got them. The casting director knew Julia White. I knew Fabio. And so that's how it just kind of unraveled. I mean, what I've learned with independent filmmaking, you just have to, you turn over every rock, you call in every favor, and that's just the name of the game. And the people that are willing to do that are the ones that can succeed, because people are okay if, you know, they'll do stuff if you don't make it uncomfortable for them. And we basically kept all those actors, they're on set for no more than like 4 hours. You know, we got them in and out. We treated them really great. They were fantastic to work with. And, that's the trick of it. You know, make sure you pull in the favor, then make sure you make their experience something positive,
good on
so
it.
That you don't, yeah, yeah, you don't get any pushback.
Yeah, and there's a lot of mid to big name actors that are looking to do independent films just to get away from the studio side of things sometimes.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, your difficulty always, though, is access, because they usually have so many barriers up, whether it's through their agents and managers, that you can't even get the material to them, you know, and that's always the walls you have to hurdle. So, listen, the filmmaking is not for the faint of heart, and you just have to just push and you know, do your best and try to, you know, make things happen, even when it seems like it won't. And it's amazing what sometimes comes together. And then I think there's also, on some level, you have to just surrender to whatever ends up being the way it's going to be is how it was meant to be, and not try to be overly controlling, because, you know, filmmaking is just such a mess of errors that kind of come together at different times. So, you know, you just, as a producer, you're just constantly putting out fires, because you just know fires will always emerge. There's just so many moving parts that something always goes wrong. And I think obviously the big mistake is not to think that. And so you just have to deal with it when it comes up. And if you lose an actor at the 11th hour, then you just have to say, well, you know, obviously that wasn't meant to be. And so let's get someone in here who does work and just trust that whoever that person's going to be is the person who's supposed to be in this movie, and not keep, you know, crying over spilled milk, because there's usually not enough time, and that type of anxiety doesn't do anyone any benefits. So you just have to keep moving forward. And, you know, the big thing I've learned is that, I've lost some friendships over, filmmaking, because, you know, you have to take the attitude that the film needs to win. And sometimes when people's personal ego gets involved, they want something a certain way just because they think it should be that way, when it's clearly not what's best for the movie, that creates friction. And I've learned that you just have to commit to this thing, that the movie's got to win at the end. That's why we're doing this. And not everyone always will step in time with that, and that's unfortunate. But I've learned I love working with friends, but sometimes when you're working with friends, they reveal sides of themselves that you haven't seen when you were just friends, not working together.
Really?
So it's one of those things that you just learn when you're going through it. And that's one of the things I remember when I first came to Hollywood. I'm like, oh, it's all such bullshit. You know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And the truth is, there's a lot of validity to that, but it's for good reason. I mean, you know, like I was saying, there's so many moving parts and so many things that can go wrong with filmmaking. You'd be crazy if you had the power not to leverage the film in your favor by stacking the deck in whatever way you can with the cast and crew that you feel confident with. And because there's just going to be stuff that happens, and you want to be able to know kind of how people cope with those situations. If you've had some experiences with them, well then, and you know that they can do the job, whether it's in front of the camera or behind it, then why, of course you're going to put them there. And of course, if you like them, it's just, you know, you're maybe out somewhere for 2 months, you might as well be around people you enjoy being with. So it was very hard for me entering into that scenario, understanding that. Now that I've been on the other side, now I get it, and I operate the same way. So it's just, you know, it's been an evolution for me.
Yeah, as an acting teacher, I tell my students all the time, if you're going to get into the business, some things you got to learn up front. If you go on to a studio set, you got to be nice, you got to be ready to do what you got to do, and don't give any problems, because you won't be around.
That's right. No, like I said, unless you get in that very rarefied movie star air, you are so replaceable. And if an attitude is the reason that you're not going to stay on set or not get hired again, I mean, yeah, you got to look in the mirror about that stuff. That's because at the end of the day,
yeah.
You know, and I've experienced this even casting actors. You know, if I've written something and I've imagined what I think the essence of the character is for that role, you know, someone's got a good dog. That essence is something that when that actor walks in the room before they've even said a word, you're measuring up that. That's kind of a person's biography. That's their stature. That's their persona. And either that will align with what you imagine to be, or it won't. And if an actor comes in and their essence doesn't really match kind of what I think the role needs, but then they come in and crush the audition, well, you always remember someone who's great and a very talented actor. But if they're just not right for the role because they just don't have that kind of, you know, chemistry that you were hoping for, you'll either try to find them another role in it because they're so talented, or certainly keep them in mind for the next time of someone that you could go back and say, that person's great. But it doesn't mean you're going to get the job. And I remember sometimes, you know, going on auditions and feeling like, oh my God, I can't do it any better than that, and not even getting a call back and taking it so personally and thinking, well, how am I ever going to make it if I go out and do an audition better than, you know, I've ever done it before and I don't even get any response? You know, what chance do I have? But now I realize there's something more dynamic that way, to not take any of that stuff personally, because you just don't know what is going on behind the scenes. And as an actor, you just got to go in and leave it all you can on the floor and just hope for the best. I mean, some actors, I have to say, even when we were casting Dumbbells, there's one guy who, when you guys see the movie, he's the loan manager, and he is hilarious. And we had actually, for whatever reason, we decided, oh, that should be like an over. This guy came in, he was very preppy with glasses and kind of, kind of had a nerdy aspect. But he just came in and he was so funny. It's like he cut up the whole room with his acting machete and basically looked at us and said, I dare you not to cast me. And that was basically not only our reaction, but Brian and I looked at each other and said, oh my God, not only is he fantastic, but we have to write him another scene, because we have to get him in the movie more. So
right.
You know, sometimes that happens, but that's kind of a character supporting role, you know. And if you're really looking for a character that's really going to be a main character, they've got to have the essence you're looking for. Otherwise, like, you're better off hiring someone who has that essence, who definitely seems capable as an actor, but may not even done the best audition. But that you just say, you know what, that's what we're looking for. I can work with that. And so actors, I wish they would be able to be in casting rooms, understand not to take things so personally, because, I mean, it can be as stupid as someone's like, oh, that girl, she reminds me of my ex-girlfriend. And she's off. She's not considered. And she may have been great. But, you know, the director or a producer might like just might have had that with some sort of personal issue with them. And that's, you know, out of your control. So I always try to encourage actors to learn much more than just acting.
It may also be so much as, hey, you were great. Audition was great. But the chemistry between you and this actress that you're going to be opposite against just isn't going to work. And they might already know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they might have already cast that role, and they kind of are looking for a certain type at that point. Yeah, so just even the color of hair might work against you at that point. You know?
With a great attitude and everything, that they're going to remember you for the next time they're casting something.
That's exactly right, because the people that really have their skill set down and really kind of, you know, have a craft, you always remember them. You know, it's the same thing with the screenplays. A friend of mine says a great screenplay glows. You know, it glows because it just doesn't happen very much. So you're always trying to get yourself into that place where, you know, you're kind of creating that type of work, you know. I can only compare it to being an athlete, where it's the type of thing of, it's like when you're in the zone, you've done all the practice, you've busted your tail, but when you're in the game, you can't be thinking about your practice. You got to just be in the moment, in the game, because every play is different. And and that's, I think, one of the catches, even with acting class, a lot of dynamics of acting classes I had taken, you fall into a very codependent mentality a lot of times. And a lot of times it's unfortunately put on by a lot of acting teachers, of where they kind of convince their students that they're the secret weapon. And while they stay in class and while they stay with them, they'll be fine. You know, whereas I've always thought, like, well, listen, I'm trying to learn how to fly. You're going to help me build my wings. But once I've got my wings, I'm going to go do my thing, you know? And
exactly.
Very often, you know, I realized that, like, that I had a very talented acting coach, but, you know, one who created that unhealthy dynamic. And when I finally left class and said, I'm going to put as much effort into as an actor, in the same way that I'm trying to get her approval every time I put a scene up. And that's when I started working. You know, because I was putting all my effort into this idea of, like, oh, if I could just put up a scene and get no notes from this acting coach, then I've arrived. And I just know now from doing a bunch of movies, you know, you're not trying to get the perfect take. The perfect take doesn't exist. And, you know, the great performances are largely formed in the edit room from grabbing the best parts of every take. So actually, the more colors you give a performance from take to take, it works great in the editing room, because it gives the director and the editor a lot more choices of how to actually work out the storytelling. But they keep thinking, you've got this way, I got to do it each time and get it perfect. You're actually sabotaging the kind of magic that happens. I mean, you know, so much of movie making is, you know, capturing lightning in the bottle. So you want to, like I say, be in that zone like an athlete, where you've just jumped into the sandbox and you're kind of in a free flow, but you're not caught in this idea that it's got to be a certain way, or if I hit this beat, it's got to be that way. You just got to be present and there and just let it all hang out and see what happens. And if it doesn't work out one take, shake it off and go do it, you know, go do it again, and not beat yourself. Don't get in that self-commentary and beat yourself up for stuff that you can just go do another take and see what happens this time.
Hoyt, talk a little bit about the film festival circuit. I know you're in the Austin Revolution Film Festival. Dumbbells is going to be shown there.
Yes, I'm very excited
about some
that.
Of the other.
Well, you know, it's funny, like James Christopher, I met at another film festival. And then again, this is, and he was telling me about his festival. And that's when I submitted to it. I mean, the whole film festival thing's a fascinating thing. I think it's hard to admit that unless you're going to like the top five or six festivals, it's not something that is necessarily going to move the needle on distribution for your movie as you initially hope. Because like Dumbbells has had a great run. We've won a whole bunch of awards and gotten into like 60 festivals. And I really only started submitting it because I saw it kind of as counter-programming to everything I was seeing out there. That everything was so heavy and intense. And most people doing independent films like, oh my God, I've got to tell this incredible story of this horrible thing that happened in my life. And so a lot of the films you see in film festivals are quite dark and quite, very serious and not very light. So I thought comedy and certainly Dumbbells could be some counter-programming in that sense. And it seems to have worked out pretty well. But I had simultaneously have another film that's going in the film festival that's been invited to over 100 film festivals. And it's been really interesting to have that level of success with that movie, but also recognize that doesn't mean the big distributors are calling you up saying, oh my God, you've won 40 best pictures. We got to take your movie out, because unless you're in one of those big festivals, which quite honestly are not going to invite a Dumbbells or even this other film, The Intersection I'm talking about, they're not going to invite us because you can submit to it, but they've gotten like a Sundance or a Tribeca or South by Southwest, they're pulling in close to 100,000 fans or attendees for that week. And it's just basic economics. They have to have star power to drive that kind of crowd. So if you don't have stars, have a flashy director, they can't program you. So it's not something you take personally. I did initially, of course, like I think every filmmaker does, like, oh, yeah, I guess it's very political. And yes, of course, there are some politics in those big festivals. But when you go into the next tier of festivals where, they're open to hearing a movie star if they come in, but they're not going to really get that many movie star-driven films submitted to them because they're smaller festivals. Those are the type of festivals that I find you have to discover what pool should you be swimming in, and that's the film festivals are a great way to target and understand not only who likes your movie, but who your target audience may be and what type of person, really kind of reacts in a positive way to what you've created or not, and I find the film festivals are really, really helpful in that way, because ultimately at the end of the day, a lot of these film festivals, all they can do is say to their growing crowd, they're trying to grow, that here's a film that you would not otherwise see. It's going to be with actors you've never probably heard of and a director you've never heard of, but it's a good movie. So come check it out. And that's kind of where most of them fall. And I mean, I don't know if you guys know, but there's like 3,000 festivals in the U.S. alone. Like,
yeah.
It is insane. So, I was starting a distribution company around the time that I was taking out Dumbbells and Intersection. So I really oversubmitted those movies, trying to understand how these festivals work just to get a pulse on it. So it's been really interesting to kind of watch that unfold and kind of find out, like I said, find out what pool each of those movies really belong in and kind of learn which ones I should submit to and kind of go from there.
As a writer, have you, as you're thinking of ideas and stuff, have you ever thought, oh, this would be a good one for this festival, and start writing towards
yes.
that?
I just try to stick to the story. I wouldn't say like I would write a script targeting a festival, but there's certainly like, I've got the next script I want to make.
That's
is
in the back
a,
of your mind, right? Love,
yeah, sure. Cause I've seen that there's a story that takes place at a mental health facility. It's a love story between a suicidal kid and a bulimic girl, and it's based on a true story. And it's not as heavy and dark as it sounds like. But then there's a festival called the Recovery Festival, because it's all really about recovery. So
yeah.
I would immediately say, like, I got that script. I'm like, well, I'm definitely going to send it there. And the other thing is you build relationships with festival directors, and they love kind of
right.
supporting. If they started you kind of off in your career, they want to help support it. And so, again, you can say those are politics, but that's the whole point of these festivals, is to kind of build an alliance amongst people and kind of do their thing. And, that's how it works. It's, you can't eliminate the human component. And I think too often when things aren't going the way that people want them to go for themselves. They want poking fingers at those type of dynamics. But the reality is that those are real dynamics that have to exist that actually determine why people make decisions. So you have to be realistic about what you're up against.
It also comes back to the same thing about working with the same actors. I mean, those festivals, they know you and they know that you're there to help promote the festival as well as your film. So they're going to want you
exactly.
back year after year.
Exactly. And that's what's been fun about, like, I love what James is doing. I mean, not only is he making movies, but he's also got a festival where he's helping other filmmakers promote their movies. I mean, those are the guys you want to align with. And you know, I hope at some point that James and I get to do a project together. I mean, I think one of the most satisfying things about going to the film festivals is realizing you're not the only one on the crazy farm. Like, you're meeting other filmmakers who are just as nuts as you are, thinking you can actually make a living doing this. You know, and most of us aren't. But the truth is, most of us in the business would do it for free. And if you know that, then it's nice to know that you're not the only one thinking that way. And that that maybe if you align yourself and find some like-minded people, you might actually be able to start upgrading your projects so that maybe everyone can succeed on a greater way and be at a win-win. And that's why I really love the festival, because there's a lot of rejection involved, but there's travel and it's expensive, and it's tough to invest in your career that way. And I came from the modeling business where I was always being paid for flights and always being staying in the nicest hotel. And then the first script, actually what I got paid for dumbbells, which took me well over a year and a half from start to finish to actually create, was what I used to make in 4 hours as a model. So that was a real paradigm shift for me, saying, it's like, oh, okay, so what I used to get in a half day is actually what it took me a year and a half to create to get to start doing the movie thing. So it's just a huge paradigm shift. But listen, that being said, I love it. Like, I wouldn't want to be doing anything else. I really enjoy the storytelling. Like I told you, I love there's no more fun place on earth than the film set. It's just it's a place where people are just creating, and there's just, there's an urgency and an energy, and it's just awesome. I love it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the documentary that you're going to be working on?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because, one of the things that you'll see in Dumbbells when you guys see it is there's a subplot of my character, Jack Guy, and where you find out Jack Guy was in a religious cult, and the cult is now trying to come back and, and find him because they think he stole money from them, and it's this whole kind of that people come to me and say, where did that come from? I'm like, well, I was in a cult. And they're like, what? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I was in a cult for 15 years. And, and it's funny because when I get in these conversations, all small talk leaves the moment I say that because just got right. And it was very serious, and it's been very healing for me to see the absurd funny side of it, like I did in Dumbbells. But the documentary is really taking the point of view of cataloging this 20-year experience I had where, I didn't see my parents for 12 years. I was completely brainwashed. I was planning for the end of the world and thinking that I was in this group that was going to help save the world. And we ended up building a compound. That's actually, why we were in North Carolina. We had 4 years of stored food and bunkers and guns, waiting for, to fight, when the apocalypse hit. And, at one point, we thought we were going to be picked up by spaceships. I mean, it was crazy from all those points of view. But when you understand how it happens very subtly. And it's not something that you ever think you're signing up for. You think you're part of this incredible opportunity that wouldn't come across hardly anyone's table, let alone your own. And for me, it was kind of like, I always describe it as, if you don't really have a game plan in your life, and I was 16 when I met my so-called guru at that time, and you meet someone who's really excited about their game plan, well, that can be really appealing to you. It certainly looks substantial compared to your no plan. And if it resonates with you on any level, you'll investigate. And that's how it started for me. And I went down a road where, you know, I cut myself off from my family and most of my friends, and I put them through absolute hell. And that's been the hardest part about going through this documentary process, is getting their testimonies of what they went through. And that's, for me, it's been hopefully the opportunity to offer some catharsis for all of us, because a lot of these conversations we're having are somewhat artificial in the sense they wouldn't normally happen, because all these conversations are hard and awkward to have. But because I'm doing the documentary with the hope that maybe this will be a resource and kind of a cautionary tale for others of how it can happen to you. I mean, I think one of the biggest myths I try to erase in the work that I do around the cult recovery community is, as long as people think like I did, which is, well, I would never join a cult, you know, you're potentially vulnerable, because, you know, the mere fact that I was in the group to me was enough of a criteria that meant it can't be a cult, because I would never join a cult.
Right.
So as long as you have that mentality, and it's just an attitude that stems from not knowing, you know, it's largely just ignorance, not knowing how these groups work and how they operate. I mean, I was actually just on Dr. Drew's show after the Paris attacks, because they wanted to get my perspective on this ISIS thing, because I was saying, you know, ISIS runs like a cult. Like, you know, everyone's worried about their sons mm-hmm. strapping on the bomb, and, you know, the kids who are putting on the bombs, they're not the problem. They're the loyal foot soldiers, but they're getting completely manipulated and brainwashed by the other people who aren't yeah. putting on the bombs, and they're not the ones who are hopping in the planes. Those are the people that are the real problem, and everyone's looking in the wrong
right.
place. And so that's what I'm hoping to do with this documentary, is really just try to educate and enlighten a little bit of how it can happen to someone that you probably wouldn't expect it to happen, you know, in this case, myself, and also describe the ripple effect. Like, you know, everyone doesn't realize that, you know, when someone goes down this path, I'm sure it's you know, it's not unlike any addict or, you know, that sort of addiction where, you know, the all the people that are around you suffered incredibly, because anytime someone goes down that path of self-destruction or self-sabotage and you feel powerless to stop them, you get wounded in the process. So there's a whole bunch of healing that needs to happen that starts with everyone understanding how it happened, so the forgiveness can kind of come into play. And a lot of times the documentaries I've seen on anything cult-related, they don't talk about the recovery process. I mean, people, you know, they want to know, like, oh, how did you get in? What was the cult leader like? What was the cult doing? How did you get away? But they don't talk about, well, how do you put your life together after something like that?
Right.
And so I really try to focus a good part of the documentary on that. And that's why I call it double exposure, because on one hand, you know, I was going down what I thought was this kind of inner spiritual journey, not realizing it was something dangerous and occult. And simultaneously, I'm living the life of Johnny Supermodel in the height of materialism, you know, late 80s and 90s, you know, flying on the Concorde and going around, you know, all over the world. So it's this weird double life that I was living, and hence the name double exposure.
Yeah, and the other thing they need to understand about cults is they're everywhere. They're not just in major metropolitan
oh, yeah.
areas or, you know, you only hear about it in the news because they're everywhere.
That's exactly right. You know, there's a cult recovery center in Ohio. There's really only one, and it barely hangs on by a shoestring because it's so underfunded. But they track about 5,000 cultic groups in America now, and a lot of them are like our group. Like, they're under 100 people, or even under 50 people. So they're basically invisible to society, but they're still, you know, causing havoc in people's lives. I mean, for me, I think the most disturbing thing about doing this documentary is just, you know, to recognize the collateral damage that occurred by this, you know, that was pinpointed by this one sociopath. And, you know, it's just mind bending to kind of go through something like that. If I hadn't actually gone through it, I don't know if I would have believed it myself. So it's just been an extraordinary journey for me, and I'm hoping, like I said, hopefully it will be resourceful to others, because I work now with families whenever I can to help them, you know, get their kids out of cultic situations, because, you know, I can give them some sort of comfort in letting them know probably what's going on with the person who's in the cult, because a lot of the things that are being said to them or the way they're being treated can be so hurtful. But I can explain the dynamics that are at play and how you're not dealing with –